The first year. 3 years. In the first, she tried to conceal her love from him. In the second, she let him see it. In the third, she offered it to him. 3 years. And she must or might see him every day, for they lived as members of one family, and there was daily fuel for her folly, great encouragement, and also great torment. For with love, we cannot speak of must and may, as Joseph had spoken to Montcalm about sleep, saying soothingly not that he must sleep, but that he might. For in love, there is a painful, involved, and bewildering struggle. It splits the soul with half-wishing, half-unwishing, so that the lover curses the must-see with as good will as he would blissfully welcome the may-see. And the more violent his anguish from the last time of seeing, the more passionately he strives for the next opportunity to aggravate his disease. This, most of all, when the patient had ground to rejoice that the pain was growing less. For it can actually happen that a meeting can tarnish the brilliance of the desired object and bring about a certain disappointment, cooling, and detachment. That should be the more welcome to the lover, since with the diminishing of his own infatuation, thanks to desire, he has a growing power of self-conquest and of inflicting on another what he suffers himself. Such would be the result were one lord and master of one's passion instead of its victim, for the chances of winning the other are greatly improved by the cooling of one's own feeling. But the lover will listen to nothing of all this. The advantages of returning sanity, coolness, and boldness, for they are advantages in pursuit of a goal which is the highest he knows, he reckons as nothing compared with the loss he imagines that he will suffer by the diminution of his feeling. He declines upon a state of desolation and emptiness comparable to that of a drug-taker deprived of his drug, and strains every muscle to regain his former state of infatuation by fresh doses of reinfecting impressions. Thus it is with must and may in the field of love's folly, which of all follies is the greatest, so that in it one may best study the nature of folly and its effect on its victim. For he, however much he may groan under the lash of his passion, is not only incapable of wishing to be free, he is even incapable of wanting to wish it. He probably knows that if he did not see the object of his passion for a certain time, quite an absurdly short time, perhaps, he would be free. But it is just forgetting of which he is more afraid than of anything else. Indeed, every pain at parting rests upon a secret dread of the inevitable forgetting. When it has happened, one can grieve no more, and therefore one grieves in advance. No one saw Moot M. Ennett's face when she hid it against the pillar after wrestling in vain with Petipre, her husband, for the sending away of Joseph. But there is much, there is everything in favor of the guess, that it was radiant with joy, because now she must see every day him who had awakened her love, and so would not be able to forget him. It must have been all-important, for her especially, and particularly strong, her dread of the parting and the inevitably ensuing forgetting, the dying down of her passion. For women of her age, when their blood has been late stirred, and perhaps without extraordinary provocation never would have been stirred, yield themselves with more than common abandon to their feelings, which are their first and may be their last, and would rather die than exchange this new life of blissful anguish for the old peace of mind which they now find so empty. It was then the more meritorious in Moot that in all seriousness and reasonableness she did what she could to persuade her indolent husband to withdraw from her eyes the object of her longing. If his nature could have brought him to grant her the favor, she would have sacrificed her feelings. But to move and arouse him was simply not possible, he being a proper captain of the guard. And the real truth is that Annie had secretly known that, and counted on it. In other words, her struggle with her husband had been a device by which his refusal should set her free for her passion and her fate. For free she might in fact consider herself after the evening in the hall at sunset. If she bridled her passions for such a long time afterwards, the reason was less duty than pride. Her carriage was lofty indeed, and only the very keenest eye could have seen any trace of weakness or tenderness shining through, when, at sunset on the day of the three conversations, she went to meet Joseph in the garden at the foot of the little summer house. Dudu had carried out his plan with the utmost slyness and shrewdness. From Joseph, he had returned to the mistress and told her that the new steward rejoiced in the opportunity of giving account of the business of the household, and laid stress on their meeting for this purpose alone and undisturbed at whatever hour and place it pleased the mistress to appoint. He would, he had said, be visiting the little house in the garden at sunset that day to inspect its furnishings and the condition of the frescoes. Dudu had given this second piece of information independently from the first, sandwiched in between other matters, delicately leaving it to the mistress to draw her own conclusions. But his maneuvers had not quite succeeded, for both parties had contented themselves with half measures. Joseph had found a middle way between his two choices, and without mounting up to the summer house, had merely walked round its base, as he might or should have done in any case, to inspect the trees and flower beds in this part of the garden. Neither had Moot, the mistress, been minded to climb the mound, but she had seen no reason why she need be prevented by what the dwarf had happened to murmur in her ear from carrying out what she remembered to have intended from the beginning, namely, to linger a while in the garden at sunset and watch the beautiful fiery sky as it mirrored itself in the duck pond. She was attended, as usual, by two of her maidens. So then, the mistress and the young steward met each other on the red-sanded path, and their encounter went off something like this. Joseph, perceiving the group, gave a little, "Oh!" of startled respect. Raising his hands, he began to move backwards, bowing as he went. Moot, on her side, smiling a little in vague surprise, shaped a casual and questioning, "Ah?" with her sinuous lips, above which her eyes looked sternly, even forbiddingly, at him. She walked forward as he retreated a few ceremonial steps, then signed to him by a little downward motion with one hand to await her. She stood still at the same time, and behind her, her dark-skinned maidens did the same, casting delighted glances with their paint-lengthened eyes, as did all the servants when they saw Joseph. In their ears, peeping from among black woolly fringes, they wore great enameled discs. It was not a meeting to afford one of the two any of the disillusion of which I spoke. The light fell slanting across the garden, bathing the scene in color and beauty. It gilded the summer house and the duck pond with rich tints, turned the sand of the path to a fiery red, gave luster to the flowers, lighted the waving foliage of the trees, and made little mirrors of men's eyes, like the mirror of the pond, whereon the ducks, both domestic and exotic, looked less like real ducks than painted and lacquered toys. And the human beings, too, looked painted and celestial in this light, as though freed from all taint of inadequacy or care. Not only in their gleaming eyes, but with their whole figures, they looked like gods and tomb images, painted and beautified by the flattering brightness, so that each must have had joy at sight of the other, as they looked out of their mirror eyes into each other's illumined faces. Moot was enraptured to see in all his perfection him whom she knew she loved. For the loving woman is ever on the lookout for justification of her love, palpitatingly sensitive to every flaw in the image of the beloved, triumphantly grateful for every favorable illusion. And if its splendor, which for the sake of her honor she cherishes, is a source of pain, because it belongs to everybody, is apparent to everybody, and must disquiet her with fear of rivals on every hand, yet even the pain is sweet beyond words, so that she presses the sword to her heart, heedless of everything, if only its sharpness be not blunted by any clouding or detraction from the image. And then Amy might joyfully conclude from Joseph's beauty that she too was beautiful, and hope that he found her lovely in his turn, even though broad daylight might perhaps betray that she was no longer in her first youthful bloom. She knew that the long, open, white woolen mantle that she wore, held at the throat over her necklace with an agraffe, for it was near the winter season, gave majesty to her figure, and that her breast stood out firm and youthful under the batiste of her garment, which fitted her closely and was embroidered with red beads round the hem. Look at it, O Sarsif. It had clasps and ribbons at the shoulders, and how well she knew that it left free her smooth and chiseled arms and revealed the splendid high haunches of her wonderful limbs. Was that not reason enough for her love to hold its head high? It did so. She pridefully behaved as though she could scarcely raise her eyelids, and so must throw her head back to look out underneath them. Her face was framed this time in a golden brown headcloth, held in place by a broad, loosely fitting band set with precious stones. A face, she trembled to think, no longer the youngest, and very unusual and irregular with its shadowed cheeks, its saddle nose, and deep-cornered mouth. Only the thought of how its ivory paleness must set off her painted, jewel-like eyes gave her courage to hope that it would not disadvantage the effect of her arms, legs, and breasts. Conscious, with mingled pride and misgiving, of her own beauty, she looked at his, at the beauty of Rachel's son in its Egyptian guise. Highly civilized it was, though the costume had an out-of-doors negligence about it. His head, indeed, was very carefully dressed, with a headcloth of ribbed black silk, which suggested a wig, and finished in curls at the bottom. Beneath it, with artful effectiveness, peeped out a corner of the clean white linen cap. But save this peruke, and the enameled collar, armbands, and flat chain of reed and gold with a scarab, he wore only the knee-length double skirt round his narrow hips, very elegantly cut, indeed, and of a sheer white, which set off charmingly the warm tone of his flesh, turned into bronze by the slanting light, and decked with its jeweled adornments. That youthful body, so exactly right in its build, strong and delicate at once, irradiated by the sunset light and freshened by the cool air, seemed not to belong to the world of the flesh, but to the purer world of Ptah's thoughts made visible. Especially the shrewd-looking head seemed to accentuate and embody, for himself as for everyone who looked at him, a gratifying union of beauty and wisdom. Very conscious of herself, in pride and misgiving, the wife of Potiphar looked at him, at his dark-skinned features, large by comparison with her own, and into the friendly night of Rachel's eyes, whose expressiveness in the face of the sun was heightened by the masculine power of understanding. She took in at once his shoulders' golden bronze gleam, the slender arm whose muscles rounded pleasantly but not unduly to hold the walking staff, and such a wave of maternal admiration and tenderness swept over her that she gasped. Her bosom was so shaken by her desperate ecstasy that it quaked visibly beneath its thin white sheath, and she could only hope that her proud bearing would give it the lie in his sight. Thus, then, and so shaken, she must speak to him. And she did so, with a self-conquest in itself alarming, because it cost her such a heroic effort. "I see," said she, coolly, "that we walk here very untimely, we idle women, and disturb the offices of him who is set over the house." "Set over the house, my mistress, is yourself alone, for you stand above it as the morning and evening star, which in the land of my mother they call Ishtar. She too is idle because divine, and we toiling ones look up for refreshment to her tranquil shining." She acknowledged his words with a gesture and a smile of understanding. She was both enchanted and pained by the spoilt way in which he wove into the compliment an allusion to his unknown mother, and seized by a gnawing jealousy of that mother, who had borne him and nourished him, guided his steps, stroked his hair out of his eyes, and kissed him by the right of her love. "We will go away," said she, "I and my handmaids who accompany me today, as always, that we may not hinder the steward, who doubtless would make sure before twilight falls that all is well in Petipre's garden, perhaps even up in the little house on the mound." "Garden and temple," replied Joseph, "concern me but little when I stand before my mistress." "But I think they should at all times concern you, and reward you for your concern more than all the rest," she answered. And already how frightfully, how wildly sweet it was, simply that they addressed each other, and said, I and you, sending out across the 2 paces of distance between their bodies the breath which created the bond and union of speech. For I have heard that they are the beginning and fount of your good fortune. I am told that it was in the little house you first did service as dumb servant, and in the orchard Petipre's eye first fell upon you when you were setting blossoms to ride. Thus it was, he laughed, and his laugh cut through her like a sacrilege. Just as you say, my lady. I was doing the service of the wind in Petipre's palm trees, at the bidding of the gardener, whom they call... But I know not why, nor may I repeat his name before you, for it is a gross and common name, unsuited to your gracious ear. She looked at his laughing face, but did not smile herself. He obviously did not know how little she was minded to jest, nor why. That was well, was inevitable, yet it hurt her. He might interpret her seriousness and lack of smiling response as a remnant of her earlier hostility, but he should perceive it. Yes, he said, I did the wind's work by the gardener's direction, when the friend of Pharaoh came and summoned me to speech, and, as I found favor before him, much took its issue from this hour. Men lived and died, she said, that you might prosper. The Hidden One does all, he replied, using an inoffensive designation for the highest. His name be praised, but truly, I often question myself whether he has not advanced me beyond my deserts. And I am anxious for my youth that such an office is laid upon me, and I have become, at not much more than 20, the eldest servant of this house. Great lady, I speak openly to you, though you hear me not alone, and are not come alone into the garden, but accompanied by maids of honor as befits your rank. They hear me too, and for good or ill hearken while the steward deplores his youth and expresses doubts for his capacity for such high service. But let them hear. For I must put up with their presence, which may not constrain me in my frankness to you, who are the sovereign of my head and my heart, my hands and my feet.